If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
There's always a fantasy element in serial killing. You kill the thing you love. Oscar Wilde said that.
I'm in Toronto, retracing the steps of a serial killer, seeing the places he saw, walking the streets where he hunted.
Police are still searching the Toronto property where the remains of six bodies were discovered.
The story of Bruce MacArthur is strange, very strange. A serial killer who spent decades living a double life, yet preyed on his own friends, hiding their remains in the backyards of the Toronto homes he was paid to maintain.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
You don't have a body, it's not a murder, generally speaking.
How is this possible? How was he not discovered? Why did the police fail to find this man despite witnesses, arrests, and evidence in plain sight?
MacArthur went on to kill five other people.
Yeah.
In the interim.
I always thought there's probably more, too, right, that they probably haven't found.
Allegations of police apathy and neglect have plagued this case from the beginning. So to find out what really happened, I've gone to Toronto, following in MacArthur's footsteps.
So how close are we to the village right
now? Oh, only a couple of blocks.
Yeah.
And by the end of this episode, you'll understand not just how Bruce MacArthur became a serial killer, but how a city failed to see a monster standing right in front of them.
He said he was going to be back, and then he never came back, and nobody knew what happened to him.
I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. In the summer of 2020, while much of the world was locked down because of COVID, I was in Toronto directing a documentary, retracing the steps of a serial killer named Bruce MacArthur. The film we made is called Catching a Serial Killer, Bruce MacArthur. And actually, it went on to win this, the 2022 Canadian Screen Award, the equivalent of an Emmy in Canada. And you can still find that movie on Amazon Prime Video in the United States and Crave in Canada. Now, the production was difficult, as you can imagine. Almost everything had to be filmed outside, but it did give me an opportunity to drive all over Ontario, meet the prosecutors and investigators who worked on the case, go through the case files, and spend time with the people who actually knew MacArthur. But before we get into all of that, let me catch you up. On January 29th, 2019, Bruce MacArthur pled guilty to 8 counts of first-degree murder in an Ontario Superior Courtroom. The charges stemmed from a series of homicides involving 8 victims, all connected to a small neighborhood in downtown Toronto called Church Wellesley, better known as the Gay Village. MacArthur's crimes attracted international attention, in part because of the almost unbelievable double life that he'd constructed. He'd worked as a mall Santa Claus. He was also a landscaper who concealed the remains of his victims inside the planters on the properties of the upscale Toronto homes he'd been entrusted to take care of.
I've been living near in the Gay Village since about 1970 on and off, but certainly the last 35 years, I had, no, more than that, 50 years.
50 years.
At least, yeah.
And you were living in this area when this all happened.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's James Dubrow, a renowned journalist, author, researcher, and a longtime advocate for Toronto's LGBTQ plus community. Now, James has spent decades writing about crime, especially organized crime, but his connection to these stories, it goes back much further than his career.
Did I ever tell you I was brought in for questioning in the Boston Strangler case?
No, I don't. Yeah, recall I was, you mentioning that.
I was a newspaper boy. I was only a kid, 16 or 17, and one of the victims in the Boston Beacon Hill was in the house in an apartment building that I used to deliver a newspaper to.
And the police called you in?
You know, they stopped me in the street and took me in a police car for a couple of hours and questioned me. I was a skinny little kid, 16.
I featured James in our original documentary on MacArthur, but for this episode, I wanted to go back to Toronto because beyond the sensational aspects of the MacArthur case, there is another story here, and it's one that I think is much more important.
This is the heart of the village, and the Black Eagle is over here.
It's here, on the streets that I'm walking with James, that men disappeared over a 7-year period. The response from the Toronto Police Service, or TPS, has since become the subject of intense criticism, including accusations that the disappearances weren't taken seriously because many of the men were gay, immigrants, or otherwise living on the margins of this community.
For a long time, it was missing people, and in fact, they were missing somewhat exotic people in the sense that they were all from South Asia immigrants to Canada.
Understanding how that happened means understanding more than just the police investigation. We have to understand Bruce MacArthur, the community he was hunting within, and the double life that he'd constructed over decades. And to do that, we have to go back, all the way back to the beginning. I remember driving out to Woodville, Ontario, a stretch of farmland north of Toronto. It's the kind of place that still smells like soil after the rain, where the horizon seems to roll on forever and every house sits a mile from the next. This is the country where Bruce MacArthur grows up. He's born Thomas Donald Bruce MacArthur in 1951 and raised on a farm outside the tiny community of Argyle, Ontario. When I was making the film about this case, I drove around the area, stopping and talking to people working their farms. Surprisingly, people still remember the MacArthur family, although given everything that's happened, most were very reluctant to speak on camera. Bruce MacArthur's mother is remembered as warm and affectionate. They describe his father using adjectives like strict, devout, hard. Now, both MacArthur's parents died decades before their son is arrested. But the people I spoke with remember Bruce as a shy kid, polite but withdrawn, growing up in what must have been an unusual and sometimes chaotic home. You see, from the time MacArthur is a child, his parents run kind of a foster home out of the family farm. They take in dozens of foster children over the years, sometimes as many as 10 at once. From the outside, this looks generous, almost saintly. But people who were there, people who knew the family, they told me that these children weren't necessarily treated like members of the family. They were put to work in the barns, in the fields, doing whatever needed to be done around the family farm. I think that detail is worth remembering. I don't think we can draw a straight line from it to what MacArthur eventually becomes. But from childhood, Bruce grows up in a household where there is a distinction between the people who belong and the people who come and go. And decades later, that distinction will become an important part of this story. Still, looking at MacArthur's childhood, we don't see the common warning signs associated with psychopathy. He doesn't appear to struggle with attachment or emotional learning. Instead, he does pretty well in school. He has friends. People from this period remember him as sort of a teacher's pet. And after his arrest, his sister will describe him as a, quote, wonderful brother. And that raises an important question. Is MacArthur hiding psychopathic traits throughout his life? Or is the sadistic violence he eventually carries out the result of something else? As we'll see, I think the answer lies somewhere in between, because from a remarkably young age, Bruce MacArthur learns to live two very different lives. And this begins back in the late 1960s when MacArthur is attending high school in nearby Fenelon Falls from grades 9 through 12. There, he meets a fellow student named Janice Campbell. They graduate in 1970 and marry soon afterwards. This begins MacArthur's double life. He and his wife spend the next several years moving around Ontario while Bruce keeps a fundamental part of himself hidden. He's gay. And to understand what that means at the time, we have to understand the world in which they meet. Because when Bruce and Janice first get together, consensual homosexual acts between adults can still be prosecuted under Canadian law. It isn't until 1969 when the federal government partially decriminalizes them. So MacArthur comes of age in a world where being openly gay can carry enormous social and potentially legal consequences. And this is when MacArthur learns how to present one version of himself to the world while keeping the other hidden. And I think this ability to compartmentalize becomes very significant. There's a sociologist named Irving Goffman who famously describes social life through the metaphor of performance. The idea is that we present different versions of ourselves depending on the audience. Now, for most of us, that's completely normal, but in MacArthur's case, that capacity for compartmentalization, it eventually becomes something much, much darker. But long before any of that, Bruce MacArthur is a department store employee with a young wife, a new home, and an internal world that appears to be slowly drifting towards sadistic fantasy. We have a remarkably detailed picture of MacArthur's fantasies given the extensive evidence recovered in this case. And how those fantasies develop is almost important as where they develop. By approximately 1975, Bruce and Janice are living in Oshawa, east of Toronto, and MacArthur begins to commute into the city. He's working as a shoe salesman at the now-defunct Canadian department store called Eaton's. If you're from Canada, you'll remember the Wish book, but I digress. According to a Canadian news program, W5, that later tracked down people who worked with MacArthur, coworkers from this period remember him as friendly, jovial, quiet, and well-mannered. There are no obvious outward signs of aggression. But what his coworkers don't see is where MacArthur is going after work. MacArthur is in his mid-20s at this point, and the department store is only blocks away from what is becoming the most vibrant LGBTQ+ community in Canada, the Gay Village, the community of Church Wellesley.
I noticed that, you know, just being here, one of the things we talk about on our show all the time is the fact that a serial killer needs access to a vulnerable population of people. You know, just looking around us, you wouldn't think of this as a vulnerable population, but it is.
Well, now it's less vulnerable. And in fact, you notice cops are around here, which is very unusual.
The history of the village stretches back into the 19th century, although for much of that history, gay life is necessarily underground. But by the time MacArthur arrives in the mid-1970s, that's beginning to change. The streets between Yonge and Bay become a cruising area frequented by male sex workers. Toronto police even refer to it as Track 2. Gay businesses, bars, and clubs are becoming increasingly visible, including the St. Charles Tavern on Yonge Street. For a closeted young man like Bruce MacArthur, he can leave his wife in Oshawa, commute to Toronto as a shoe salesman, and disappear into a community where he can meet other men. And somewhere within this hidden part of MacArthur's life, his sexuality begins to intersect with fantasies involving sadism and control. Now, MacArthur won't openly come out for roughly another 15 years or so. But when James and I were walking through the village, we were reminded just how long MacArthur had been moving through this community.
I was telling the coffee guy there that I was here doing a little podcast about the MacArthur guy. He knew MacArthur right away. And then this other guy said, oh yeah, I knew him. He seemed to be legit, but I don't know.
Yeah, we'll find out.
While walking through the village, James and I meet a man I'll call Tyler. He encountered MacArthur at a bar called Chaps, which closed in 1990. It gives us a rare glimpse of MacArthur before anyone knew who he was.
What was he like? Like, was he charismatic?
Was he was charming, he was good-looking, he was...
Really?
Fun. He was a good dancer. We talked a lot about that. And gardening, I was really into that. He was really into that.
Tyler tells us that he had a brief sexual relationship with MacArthur in 1988 or 1989. At that time, MacArthur would have been about 37 years old.
Was he into mild S&M then? Or?
Well, and that never came up, and it was a mutual place that we went to meet. I didn't go back to his place or in his van or anything.
That's good.
I think that came.
He did the
years
killings
later,
in his place and the van. You know,
would
that.
Have been like 88, 89, like way back.
Yeah.
He was not doing killing or any violence until 2001.
I don't know if I believe that.
It's probably true, but he was still married in 88.
Well,
that's another
doesn't
story.
Mean anything.
I know it doesn't.
I didn't know him the years after when all that was happening.
There's something important happening psychologically during these years. If you've listened to the podcast before, you know that I'm partial to Freud's branch of psychology called psychoanalysis. And there's a psychoanalytic concept called projective identification that I think is useful for understanding MacArthur, particularly given the violence that is still to come. The basic idea is that a person takes an unwanted or intolerable part of themselves and unconsciously projects it onto somebody else. That other person then comes to represent the very thing that the projector can't tolerate within themselves. And once those traits have been placed outside the self, they can be controlled, punished, even destroyed. And in MacArthur's case, that gives us an interesting way of thinking about the contradiction between his attraction to men and the extraordinary violence he will eventually direct towards them.
What do you think the role of fantasy plays with MacArthur?
There's always a fantasy element in killing, as I said, in serial killing, because what it is you're trying to be one with the person. You hate yourself for being gay, and so you kill it. You know, it's an old. I don't have to be a psychologist to know this. Mm-hmm. If you really hate being gay, and he was married, don't forget, with children, then you kill it. You know, you kill the thing you love. Oscar Wilde said that.
As part of this conflict, MacArthur also has to mitigate risk. Not just the risk of being discovered, which does threaten the entire life he's constructed, but the inherent risk in all intimacy. I'm talking about rejection. This is when MacArthur begins to construct scenarios that remove all uncertainty. He imagines crimes that don't end with murder. MacArthur is what's known in the literature as a fetishistic necrophile. And that term is easy to misunderstand because necrophilia doesn't necessarily mean intimacy with the dead. In fetishistic necrophilia, gratification can instead become attached to possessing something belonging to the dead. I'm talking about an object, a photograph, a part of the remains, a keepsake, something that allows the fantasy to continue after the person is gone. And for MacArthur, that distinction becomes incredibly significant. Now, at this point in MacArthur's life, I should stress that we don't actually know when he crosses the line. His first confirmed homicide doesn't occur until decades later, in 2010, when MacArthur is 58 years old, which is extraordinarily late. Large data sets of known serial killers put the average age that they begin killing at around 28. MacArthur is roughly 30 years older than that, and that doesn't mean that someone can't begin at 58, but statistically, MacArthur is way outside the normal pattern. And that creates a 40-year question in the story. What happens between the young man exploring Toronto in the 1980s and the first murder we can actually prove in 2010? Is MacArthur's fantasy escalating slowly during this period, or are there victims we simply don't know about? Now, there's no evidence that allows us to answer that question definitively, but we know that since MacArthur's arrest, the Toronto Police Service have been reviewing old unsolved homicides for possible connections. Now, thus far, investigators have looked at between 20 and 30 cold cases, including murders dating back to the 1970s. And as of now, police have not established a link between MacArthur and any of those earlier cases. But there are still many unanswered questions. So for now, simply consider that there is a long, dark gap between the fantasies we know MacArthur is developing and the first murder we can prove he commits. Back in 1995, after nearly 25 years of marriage, MacArthur comes out to his wife. But according to people who knew the couple, this confession doesn't immediately end MacArthur's double life. Bruce MacArthur and Janice remain under the same roof, and they continue on as normal, essentially. They share dinners, holidays, family routines, all at least in part to maintain a sense of normalcy for their two children. But behind closed doors, we know that Bruce MacArthur begins a relationship with another married man at this time. By the late 1990s, this situation becomes untenable. That's when MacArthur separates from his wife and leaves his family in the suburbs behind, moving to an apartment close to the village. We know that around this period, MacArthur is visiting fetish websites and BDSM chat rooms because police later recover these records. And based on his online activity, we can begin to see MacArthur's fantasies coalescing. This culminates on Halloween night 2001. Police arrest MacArthur after he assaults a man with a metal pipe during a sexual encounter. When questioned, MacArthur tells police that shortly after entering the victim's apartment, he blacked out. He claims he doesn't know how or why he assaulted the man. It's a flimsy excuse and essentially forces MacArthur to plead guilty. But when he does, the court orders a full psychological assessment. I have the assessment right here. I'm actually reading it right now. And in light of everything we know, parts of it seem almost unbelievable. The report describes MacArthur as articulate and coherent. It says MacArthur shows, quote, no trace of antisocial behavior. And then there's the conclusion. I'll read it to you. Quote, psychological testing shows no sign of mental health problems and no sign that may allow one to conclude a risk of violence. End quote. The failure here is apparent, and this assessment, it enables MacArthur to avoid prison. He receives a conditional sentence of 729 days, 2 years less a day. The first year is spent under house arrest, followed by a six-month curfew. Eventually, MacArthur applies for a record suspension, the Canadian equivalent of a pardon, and he gets it. So his criminal record is effectively sealed from ordinary background checks, and that clean slate, it will have enormous consequences. So by 2002, MacArthur is not only a fixture in the gay village, but he's able to start his own business, founding a landscaping company after losing his job. On the surface, he seems to be building something of his own, but knowing where the story goes, I can't help but notice a similarity to another serial killer that we've covered on this podcast, John Wayne Gacy. Gacy operated a small contracting business out of his home. MacArthur operates a landscaping business. And both those businesses give the men who run them something extremely important. Access to vulnerable men looking for work.
MacArthur, he didn't usually pick up hustlers and street people.
Right.
He usually picked up poor immigrants from South Asia who needed work, and he would give them work in his landscape business.
This is what most people miss about MacArthur's occupation. Whether or not the landscaping business begins with malicious intent, it eventually provides almost everything he needs to commit the murders. And then there's this. At this time, MacArthur is living in a small apartment with a roommate near the village and needs somewhere to store his landscaping equipment. So he turns to an old family friend, a woman named Karen Fraser. Karen and her husband Ron own a home in Leaside. It's a quiet, tree-lined neighborhood in Midtown Toronto. And they've known the MacArthur family for years. Bruce makes a deal with the couple to take care of their yard in exchange for space in their garage to store his equipment. And every summer when the couple head north to their cottage, they leave Bruce MacArthur with full access to their home. Now, I've walked this property several times, and I've spent time there with Karen Fraser. It's an upscale residential neighborhood, but behind the house, the backyard drops towards a small ravine. This is where MacArthur ultimately disposes of the majority of his victims' remains. We'll get to that, but standing there, you can immediately understand the privacy that this unique property offers. Back in 2007, MacArthur moves into a new apartment at Leaside Towers. It's not far from the village. He buys a red minivan, his favorite bar called Sneakers. It closes, and he begins to spend time at another village bar where he meets a man named Skanda Navaratnam.
Where are we now?
Yeah.
We're walking towards the main part of the village. This is Jarvis, and actually, this is a very important spot. Right over here where this building is, 120, is where he picked up his first victim.
At the time, Skanda is 40 years old. He's a Sri Lankan national who fled persecution for being gay and came to Canada looking for safety, community, maybe even companionship. Friends describe him as kind, gentle, and proud. Now, MacArthur doesn't initially target Skanda. He befriends him. The two are seen together extensively. MacArthur and Skanda are connected on Facebook. MacArthur hires him. Karen Fraser even told me she had met Skanda landscaping in her backyard.
It would have been 2010. Where are we now? 16 years ago, he picked him up in a bar over there called Zippers, which has been torn down and a condo has been built, which is a very popular gay dance bar. And the last time they ever saw Skanda was leaving Zippers here with somebody. They didn't know it was Bruce MacArthur at that point.
James is referring to Labor Day, September 6th, 2010. We don't know exactly what happens during the homicide, but years later, police will recover Skanda's personalized bracelet from MacArthur's bedroom. And on MacArthur's electronic devices, they discover photographs of Skanda's body. The evidence suggests that MacArthur asphyxiates him, likely either in his apartment or his van. After the homicide, MacArthur dismembers Skanda's remains, keeping part of them as totems, which he buries inside a large gardening planter in the backyard of Karen Fraser's property. And this is where the psychology we've been talking about becomes tangible. MacArthur's paraphilia, it won't allow him to simply dispose of the victim and move on. This is behavior he repeats over and over and over again. He returns to the Fraser property. He works there. He surrounds himself with the very planters in which he's concealed the victim's remains. Years later, while making the documentary film, Karen Fraser showed me where Bruce and his crew would take their lunch breaks in her backyard. He would actually gather the planters around a picnic table, and the men he employed would sit there and eat.
He put them in the planters after he cut them up. And
he seemed to want to keep the victims around
him. Oh, he kept
him.
Part of them. Yeah, right. Oh, and he saw the victims almost every day when he went to do work on the... He had a garden, a landscape business where the planters were.
Have you ever been over to that house?
No, I avoided that.
No, yeah. I went over to the house when we were making the documentary. And one thing that stuck out to me was just the fact that, you know, he would set up a table much like this one for lunch in this garden. And the planters in which he had left the victims,
right there.
They were all around.
Oh, yeah, that was the point. Yeah, his Dahmer did that, too. He wanted them around him.
Yeah.
And he had the head in the freezer, you know, and he wanted them to be part of him. They were boys in that case, but it's all the same.
Skanda's disappearance is reported by a friend about 10 days later. But initially, there's very little investigation here. And I can't help thinking about what psychologists sometimes describe as a killer's sense of perceived omnipotence during this period. If Skanda really is MacArthur's first murder, just think about how brazen that is. This isn't a stranger MacArthur randomly encountered, yet the police never come knocking. For MacArthur, that has to be reinforcing. Whatever fear he had before this murder, afterwards, he must feel increasingly powerful. And perhaps that explains why it's only a few months before Bruce MacArthur targets his next victim, Basir Fazi. At the time, Basir is 42 years old, married, and the father of two daughters. To his family, he is a loving husband and hard worker, but privately, Basir is living with a secret. He is not heterosexual. And this becomes an important part of understanding what happens in the MacArthur investigation, because some of the men who disappear are closeted. Their families don't necessarily know that they're spending time in the gay village.
It seems several of the victims were living like a double life.
Oh yeah, a lot of them. Right. Some of them were straight. Some of them were secretly gay. Four of them were from South Asia, you know, from Sri Lanka.
According to investigative records, on December 29th, 2010, Basir calls his wife from work and tells her that he's going to meet a friend for a drink. Instead, he travels into church in Wellesley and visits a bathhouse called Steamworks. It's believed that he and MacArthur either meet there or they arrange to meet around this time, although exactly how the two men connect remains unclear. What the evidence eventually shows is that Basir ends up with Bruce MacArthur, and evidence recovered after MacArthur's arrest indicates that he uses a prepared ligature to kill Basir. Afterwards, MacArthur photographs the body. Now, those photographs are disturbing, and obviously I can't show them on these platforms, but from an investigative perspective, they're extraordinarily important because they give us another window into the escalation of MacArthur's evolving necrophilic fantasy. At this time, MacArthur is developing a fixation on particular features and objects. He carefully removes and collects the hair from his victims, then seals it inside plastic Ziploc bags, keeping it among his belongings in the tool sheds of his clients. And viewed through MacArthur's classification of fetishistic necrophilia, this behavior makes sense within the fantasy that we've been tracing thus far. And this ritual, it continues to develop with MacArthur's next victim. Hamid Kahan is another familiar face in the village. An immigrant from Afghanistan who's built a life within Toronto's gay community, who meets MacArthur at a bar called the Black Eagle.
This is the heart of the village. Mm-hmm. And the Black Eagle is over here. It was a kind of mild S&M bar. Mm-hmm. It's part of a chain, if you look it up, Black Eagle chain of early, going back early in the 60s and 50s. It was the first S&M chain, cowboy S&M. Mm-hmm. And there he'd meet people there, and he went with some of the people he killed there.
Just like Skanda, the first victim, Hamid isn't some anonymous stranger that MacArthur encounters once. MacArthur knows him. MacArthur and Hamid date. On October 18th, 2012, Hamid is last seen near Alexander and Young Streets, not far from the village. No one knows exactly how he and MacArthur connect that day, whether the meeting is planned or simply an encounter between these two men who know each other. But we know that Hamid disappears at this time. And the evidence that MacArthur leaves behind, it shows us that his post-mortem ritual is becoming increasingly elaborate. Afterwards, he once again transports the remains, burying them in the large planters at the Fraser property. And this brings up another important aspect of MacArthur's crimes. No remains from any of the victims are ever discovered before his arrest. For years, there are no bodies, no crime scenes, and no physical evidence establishing that a homicide has ever even taken place.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
If you don't have a body, it's not a murder, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And if it's people who are recent immigrants or don't speak English or aren't that conversant with policing, then it's not even reported.
At the same time, MacArthur is creating another kind of burial ground, a digital one. He creates folders on his computer that are named for his victims. Inside, he keeps the photographs that he's taken himself, along with any other images he can find online.
That's the other thing these people do nowadays with all these electronic things, is they keep pictures,
right.
Or Bernardo did that too.
Yeah.
They keep video of their escapades.
Now, you may have noticed that I've said relatively little about the police investigation so far, and that's because initially, there isn't much of one. When Skanda vanishes, his friends report him missing. When Basir disappears, his wife reports him missing. And when Hamid disappears, his son reports him missing. Yet, almost no investigation is done into any of the three cases. Still, the community takes notice. People begin to talk about the disappearances. There are rumors that a predator is operating in the village. Friends and activists raise alarms, vigils are even held. At one point, community organizations even demand answers from the police. And by November of 2012, the Toronto Police Service finally creates a dedicated investigation that they call Project Houston.
This is where the cops came right up and down during Houston with signs saying these people are missing, three people. Mm-hmm. And they had them in all the windows here. Different shops were here that, you know, it's a long time ago now.
And when was that? What year was that?
2010 to 2012.
Right. And at that time, the police were insisting there wasn't a serial killer. Right?
Well, they didn't have any clue.
In fact, the task force is originally created to investigate a series of international tips about online cannibalism that appear to be coming from Toronto. It doesn't have anything to do with the missing men, at least initially. Now, these allegations turn out to be absolutely nothing. But during the investigation, the task force does consider the unsolved disappearances in the village. In Skanda's contacts, detectives even find Bruce MacArthur's email address and his online handle, which is silverfox2x51. That's when police interview MacArthur during the Project Houston task force. Now, that interview is not publicly available, but we know from the subsequent review of the investigation that MacArthur denies knowing Basir Fazi. He does, however, acknowledge his connections to the two other victims. But the detective who interviews MacArthur does not properly investigate his background. He doesn't run any sort of database check. He doesn't prepare questions about MacArthur's known connections to the victims. In fact, the entire interview lasts just 16 minutes, after which MacArthur walks away. And in 2014, Project Houston is quietly shut down, though it's not the last time that the Toronto police interview MacArthur and release him without consequence. In terms of Project Houston, the final police summary reads, quote, "Over 100 interviews with friends, family, neighbors, and acquaintances were conducted, but the investigation failed to uncover what happened to the three men," end quote.
He had been interviewed several times. They let him go over the years.
Yeah, did you, like, what do you make of that? Because,
well, it was incompetence.
It was just incompetence.
Well, it was. I mean, well, they say a lot of things. I think they should have stuck with it because they had a special operation called Project Houston that went on from 2012 to 2014, which got sidetracked. So MacArthur went on to kill five other people in the interim.
By 2015, Bruce MacArthur's pattern is becoming well established. On August 15th, he targets his fourth victim, Sarush Mahmoodi, 50 years old. Like some of MacArthur's previous victims, Sarush is living a life that makes retracing his final movements difficult. He's married with a stepson, an Iranian immigrant who has built a life in Canada and remembered by family and friends as hardworking and well-liked. And because of this, no one knows exactly how Sarush and MacArthur meet or what brings them together on the day he disappears. Sarush is last seen asleep in his own bed. When he fails to show up for work, his family reports him missing. Now, evidence recovered years later shows that MacArthur kills Sarush and once again performs the ritual that we've seen developing, though the staging is becoming increasingly elaborate. MacArthur dismembers and conceals the remains in two planters at Karen Fraser's house, hiding death among the flowers. Police will eventually recover rope, duct tape, restraints, gloves, cutting tools, hard drives, all from the properties that MacArthur tended as a landscaper. 5 months later, in January of 2016, MacArthur targets Kumar Kenagaratnam. Kumar is an asylum seeker from Sri Lanka. His life here is precarious. He even faces deportation and eventually disappears into Toronto's Tamil community. So when Kumar disappears, nobody reports him missing because his family and friends believe that he's hiding from immigration authorities. 3 months later, on April 23rd, 2016, MacArthur targets Dean Lisowick, a bisexual man struggling with homelessness who's well known around Church Street.
We're in the heart of the gay village, mm-hmm. Dean Liswick, one of the victims, who was a street person, used to work that corner right over there, this side of the Pizza Nova thing, where just a few doors up from the bank. He hung out in the corner, and you gave him money, or he picked up people. That could be where MacArthur picked him up. I think it probably is.
Dean Lisowick's remains will be recovered almost 2 years later, after MacArthur's arrest. And just like Kumar, Dean Lisowick is never reported missing. 1 year later, MacArthur kills Salim Essen, another man living precariously around the village.
The other thing about these people that were immigrants, nobody reported them missing, or if they did, only one or two people did, and there weren't a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. So it was, just went through the... And several of the victims they discovered later were never even reported missing by anyone.
Evidence recovered after MacArthur's arrest shows the same ritual escalating again. MacArthur strangles Salim and photographs his body in multiple poses. By now, MacArthur has killed at least 7 men in 7 years. And yet nobody sees the entire pattern. In fact, to most of the people around him, Bruce MacArthur isn't a predator at all. He's a friendly landscaper, a father, a grandfather at this point. And during the holidays, Bruce MacArthur puts on a red suit, white beard, and spends his days smiling for photographs with children as a mall Santa Claus.
So how close are we to the village right
now? Oh, only a couple of blocks.
Yeah. It's just down this way.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the victims of MacArthur lived not far from here.
Oh, which one was that?
Andrew Kinsman.
Right.
A few blocks from here. And so his friends and family dedicated a bench.
In the end, Bruce MacArthur's downfall is his final victim, Andrew Kinsman, a man MacArthur has known and dated for more than 10 years. This is the phenomenon that we've seen again and again with serial killers, one I touched on earlier, perceived omnipotence. Every time they kill without consequence, the more powerful they feel.
Salim Essen and Andrew Kinsman went missing in the spring of and the summer of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the alarms went off, because Andrew Kinsman was a fairly well-known person in the gay community. Everyone knew him.
MacArthur and Andrew Kinsman have vacationed together in Niagara Falls. And importantly, Kinsman is different from several of MacArthur's earlier victims in some crucial ways. He's white, he's well known in the community, and he's deeply connected. He volunteers with the AIDS organizations and community outreach projects. He has friends and neighbors who know his routines, and they know when something isn't right. So, on June 26th, 2017, security footage captures Andrew outside his apartment getting into Bruce MacArthur's red 2004 Dodge Caravan. It's believed that MacArthur takes Andrew back to his apartment and kills him there. Afterwards, he performs the ritual we've now seen developing over decades. At the same time, a neighbor reports Kinsman missing, and when investigators enter Andrew's apartment, they find something remarkably simple.
Kinsman was the key to it all, to unraveling the whole thing, solving it. The police were able to deduce on Andrew Kinsman's calendar the day he went missing. He had written Bruce in the time they were supposed to meet him that afternoon.
What James is referring to is a calendar entry that police find inside Andrew Kinsman's home. And the time and date coincide with Kinsman's disappearance. The entry on June 26th reads simply Bruce, 3 p.m. And I need to pause here because what happens next is essentially another story unto itself. Toronto police launch a new investigation that they call Project Prism. What follows is roughly 6 months of surveillance, forensic work, and painstaking investigation that ultimately confirms Bruce MacArthur as the serial killer. I have spent time with the detectives, sat down with a prosecutor, and I can say that there is some genuinely excellent police work during Project Prism. But it's impossible to look at it outside of the context of everything that came before, because by then, 8 men are dead. Meaning, though the task force is effective, it comes much too late. But by January 18th, 2018, police have MacArthur under surveillance when they watch another man arrive at his apartment building. The surveillance team knows enough about MacArthur by this point to understand what that might mean, so they move. At the time, there is only one working elevator in the building, and MacArthur lives on the 19th floor. So officers pile inside and ride upward, knowing that somewhere above them is a suspected serial killer, and a man has just entered his apartment. And when officers burst into the apartment, MacArthur has this victim handcuffed to the bed and restrained. They literally catch him in the act. They interrupt the ritual we've been tracing throughout this entire story. Only this time, before MacArthur can complete the fantasy, police come through the door. It's then that Bruce MacArthur is arrested on the spot. After MacArthur's arrest, the investigation is nowhere near over. Police spend months going through his apartment, his vehicle, his digital devices, and the properties where he worked. Investigators also have to wait for the ground to thaw before they can properly excavate portions of the Fraser backyard. But by the summer of 2018, police are digging, and on July 4th, investigators uncover the large blue plastic bin that MacArthur had buried in the ravine. It takes another year before Bruce MacArthur finally appears in court to answer for all eight murders. On January 29th, 2019, MacArthur pleads guilty to eight counts of first-degree murder. That's when MacArthur is sentenced to life in prison, with no possibility of parole for 25 years. Now, Canada does not have a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, though by the time MacArthur becomes eligible, he'll be 91 years old.
I always thought there's probably more, too, right, that they probably haven't found. Yeah, because there were so many undocumented immigrants at that time. So I think, it wouldn't have surprised me, but he went into prison with secrets, so I think they'll go to his grave.
That's Tyler, who we met earlier in this episode, the man who encountered MacArthur in the gay village in the late 1980s. And although Bruce MacArthur will likely spend the rest of his life in prison, the truth is, the damage he left behind extends far beyond those eight murders. It damaged the already fraught relationship between Toronto's LGBTQ+ community and the police who are supposed to be protecting them. The scars aren't buried in the planters anymore, but for anyone who spent time in Toronto and walked the streets of Church and Wellesley, they're still there. Before we wrap, a few show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to support the channel, I'd appreciate it if you checked out my novel, A Plague of Steel. It's a dark fantasy about a battle-hardened soldier who discovers that the legendary weapon he spent his life fearing has chosen him instead. This drags him into a war between humanity and ancient evils that have been waiting nearly 1,000 years to return. And if you do pick it up, please leave a review. If you're watching on YouTube, we've just opened our members portal and we encourage you to join, support the show, support the research, and watch early ad-free episodes. You can also find additional research on Unmarked Case Files, which is our Patreon, where you can examine the evidence for yourself. This episode of Unmarked was produced by John Nadeau and edited by Dave Alderson. Our associate producer is Jesse Demaray. Until next week, this is Unmarked.